Welcome to this podcast from Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. This podcast is made possible through support from the members of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about events or membership, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum or join us on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. You can find Inforum online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum, and I'm Orly Kotel of the Sierra Club. Tonight we have a special guest. A psychologist, professor, and author, Sam Gosling, has discovered a method of uncovering what your stuff says about you in his book, Snoop. Please welcome Sam Gosling. So let's start with how you came to this topic. Have you been snooping through people's things for a long time? I mean, did snooping lead you to psychology, or did psychology lead you to snooping?
I think snooping led me to psychology, but I think it's something we all do. That's the point. I think if you think about what in our environment offers us the greatest opportunities and the greatest threats, it's other people. And I think that... And so I think we're really hungry to find information. We're constantly searching for information, and I think that's why we do it. So I think when we go into people's places, we're all looking, we're drinking up the information. And I think it's so automatic, we don't even notice we do it unless we get a surprise. So, you know, you meet someone for the first time, you think, oh, that's a nice person, then you go back to their place, and then you arrive and they have, you know, a huge collection of plastic goldfish or something like that on the wall, and you think, oh, that's odd, and it's only when you're struck by how odd it is that it comes to the surface that's what you're doing. But you must be doing it all the time, so I think we all do it. And just as a psychologist, I thought, well, let's see what there is to it, you know.
So what actually qualifies as snooping as opposed to just living and observing?
Well, I think one is a more favorable way of describing the other thing. And I think we're all doing it, you know.
All right, let's get into how you conduct what you could call your snoopologist research.
Yeah.
How do you do it?
Well, we've done a whole bunch of studies, and we're really interested in people's spaces, their personal spaces, their workspaces, and I have a really broad conception of what I mean by people's spaces here. So I don't just mean physical spaces. We look at people's homes, also their offices, but we also the music they surround themselves with. So that's a sort of oral environment, and the virtual spaces. Looking at their websites, we've started to do a lot of work recently on Facebook, and that's another sort of virtual space that people create for themselves in a way. But across context, we do the same kind of thing. What we do is we take a team of researchers, and we send them into somebody's space. Now, before you can do that, you really have to prepare the space so that other things don't get in the way and mess up these judgments. When we did our first study, we covered up people's names because the people who are being snooped had to be anonymous. Otherwise they wouldn't have agreed to be snooped. But then we also took their photos, and photos are a very interesting thing because we know people form impressions of others based on what they look like. We know they do that. And so our first hunch was, okay, well, let's just take the photos out. Let's take them out. But then it became really interesting. We thought, well, actually, photos are important. Which photos do you put up? Do you have a photo of yourself sort of perching on the top of a train as it, you know, goes up the mountains in Rajasthan? You know, that says one thing, and that says something very different to having a photo with you, with all of your friends, all drunk, arm in arm, yelling at the camera, which other people have. So you don't want to remove it. You know, you don't. So we wanted to keep the photos in there. So what we did was we took yellow Post-it stickers, and we put those over the actual person, but you could still see what was going on, which itself led to all kinds of weird things. I mean, first of all, as soon as you go into somebody's space, you immediately see huge differences. Some people don't have a single photo. Some people's spaces are plastered with yellow Post-its, essentially, because they have so many photos of themselves. So what we did there was we prepared these spaces, and I sent my team in, and I said, okay, tell us what you think this person's like. And they come out, and I send a different team in, and they go in and they assess the environment itself. So is it inviting? Is it colorful? Is it distinctive? Is there books? What are the books? Are they varied books? Is there a clock there? Is it on time? Is there trash? Has it been emptied? All those sorts of things. And then we ask the occupant, him or herself, they take a personality test, and we also get the occupant's friends to take to tell us what the occupant's like, because you can't always trust what people say about themselves, because sometimes other people have better insight into what you're like than you do.
So how accurate were the results?
Well, the results were accurate, and they varied across trait and across domain. So the question is, you know, where should you go to find out about somebody? The answer is, well, it depends what you want to find out. So places like bedrooms are very good for discovering some traits. In particular, a trait which I call the sort of Leonardo factor, and in my field we call it openness, but this is really people who are very broad-minded. They like to try new things. If they go to a restaurant, they'll open the menu and they'll say, I've never heard of that, I'll have that. Whereas people lower on this trait say, I like the spaghetti, I know what I like, I'm going to get the spaghetti wherever they go. So, you know, and it's just, not one's not better than the other, but they're just different outlooks to life. So that trait you can pick up pretty accurately in many of the contexts we've looked at, in offices and living spaces too.
And how would you pick that up?
Well, the traits for that, and it makes sense if you go back and think of what does this trait consist of, and it really consists of being interested in differences, in abstract ideas. So these people, in fact, the biggest clue to these people is they have a distinctive space. So it's hard to put your finger on a specific item, because each one is different. But some of the places we looked at, so for example, one of the people we assessed who had the most, who was one of the highest on openness, he had a bedside lamp made out of an old bottle of vodka and Prozac bottles all around it like that, okay? So that was good. So you can't, and that, you know, and I think this gets on an important point about why you can't just say, is there a code book, you know, because there is no code book that would say bottle of vodka and Prozac, right? It has to say distinctive. And, you know, others, you know, had, you know, like a desk made out of a surfboard or, you know, or a stuffed fish sitting on top of the computer. So it's really very distinctive things. That's really one of the keys.
Does that mean that openness and creativity are correlated?
Absolutely, yes. So creativity is a part of openness. Yeah, so they are associated. Other things which are really key are the variety of things. So the variety of books, the variety of music, the variety of magazines, and more so than the volume. So if you go in and you see a big book collection, and it's far more diagnostic that you have 10 books, each on a different topic, than 50 books, all of them on some sort of narrow aspect of, you know, law or, I don't know, some engineering. I don't know, something very, just one single thing. So it's the variety that's the key here, not just the amount.
This is making me feel better that I subscribe to both The New Yorker and People magazine, which has been a hidden guilty pleasure. Now I can say it's my Leonardo factor, my Da Vinci factor. So I'm curious, when you were doing this research, were you also tracking and studying the people who were doing the snooping? For example, are men better snoopers than women?
We were tracking a little bit. The trouble is we didn't have enough judges to really look at that question systematically, because you do that. We did. There were some people who were better than others. And there are a number of reasons why this might be. One of the reasons is expertise, and some people just have more expertise. So, for example, if I was to go around snooping a woman's place, I would probably want to take, or at least have access to, some woman to be able to answer some of the questions that I would never be able to know. Because I go in, right? So, a woman goes into a woman's place and has more expertise in certain things, and say, "Ah, I see. She has MAC lipstick there, not CoverGirl or something like that." Whereas I go in there and say, Yeah, there's a lipstick there or something like that. And you know, and so it's just having those. And in fact, I first noticed that when we were practicing for our first study. For our first study, I had people. I needed my team to practice, and they needed to practice in an area that we weren't actually going to study. So I got them to practice in my room without telling them it was my room. And afterwards, after the study came, a couple of the guys came up and said, "Was that your room?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "How do you know?" Because, well, I know what car you drive, and I saw the car manuals in the bookshelf, and so I figured it out. And so I said, "Yeah, it wasn't." Then a couple of the female judges came up and said, "Was that yours?" "Well, I saw the clothes, and I know what clothes you wear." And so it was really, it reflected these distinctions in interests and what we pay attention to. So there are some expertise effects.
Now, what are some of the mistakes that your team would make?
Well, there are a number of mistakes you can make in how you go about it and the sorts of things that you will judge. So, for example, in people's places, people will go in, and if they come to a room that is very organized and tidy, there's no clutter around, all the pencils have been sharpened, they're in the right place, the books are alphabetized, they're all lined up and that sort of thing, they will correctly judge you as being higher on this trait of conscientiousness, which is sort of the conscientiousness. The way of thinking about that is this what you want your air traffic controllers to be really high on? That is, they turn up to work on time, they don't forget about stuff, they focus on the task, they don't, you know. So it's really people who are organized, on the ball. So people high on this factor, and so those cues are indeed correct signals of that trait. However, people will go beyond that. They'll go beyond that and make mistakes. They will use those cues as signals that somebody is also high on agreeableness. So they're nicer. And in fact, those cues tell you nothing about how nice somebody is. Yet we all go in and we automatically form that judgment about people. I mean, there are other mistakes we make too. Can I tell you about other mistakes?
Yeah,
okay. So one of the mistakes is a really interesting one, and it's one that it's very hard, even when you're a seasoned snooper, not to do. And that is to weigh heavily distinctive information. So what you do is when it's very hard not to go in, and when something sticks out, go over to it. So one of the rooms we assessed, it was clearly the room of somebody who was sort of organized and socially responsible. They had their desk was neat and tidy. They had a calendar on the wall. They had crossed stuff up. They were doing sort of all sorts of socially responsible things. This clearly wasn't a rebel. It wasn't a rule breaker or so on. Yet, over in the corner of the room, there was a plastic crate full of drug paraphernalia with like a bong and all that kind of stuff like that. And this really stuck out. And understandably, the judges walk into the room and they do a double take and they see that and they go straight over to that and they weigh it heavily. Now, it stuck out in that room in a way it wouldn't have stuck out in a more kind of rebel, reckless, less responsible person's room. It stuck out in that room because it was inconsistent. But because it was inconsistent, that is why they should have ignored it. Because we're really, when we're snooping, we're looking for consistencies. We're looking for signs that this is something this person does over time. And so when I asked the person, I said, "Why did you have this?" I later asked the occupant, "What was this thing doing in your room?" And she said, "Well, my housemate had gone traveling for a while, and she asked me to look after her stuff, so I put it in a plastic crate and put it in the corner." So it did reflect her social, her responsible, careful behavior, putting it all together and storing it. But it didn't reflect, you know, her attitude. And this, you know, and it was only after this experience that I remembered what I thought back to a time when we started doing the research. We had a couple of FBI agents come out and talk to us. We thought, well, this is what they do. They're assessing people's space. Let's see if they can. Let's see if they can provide some insight. And the FBI officer came, and he came and said, what he does when he gets to a crime scene is he goes and he sits in the space and he just sits there for a while. And I you know, quite frankly, I thought it was a little bit sort of new age and a little bit mystical, and I was a little bit worried about it. But now, in retrospect, I realize what he was doing was he wanted to go into a space and let these things that really stick out just fade a bit. It's like, you know, it's like when you're going for a walk in the countryside. That's how I like to think about it. When you go for a walk in the countryside, you just don't notice stuff. And then only when you stop, you know, you begin to notice the bugs crawling and the leaves and those sort of. And I think it's his equivalent to doing that, is to really sort of look for these themes across the space.
Can people easily fake the impression that their personal environment conveys?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really interesting question, because there are a number of reasons why it's hard to fake spaces, and it's also there. It's worth bearing in mind that I think we don't want to fake. I mean, there are contexts where we do, but a lot of research has shown over the past couple of decades in psychology that people generally like to be seen as they see themselves. So I think an awful lot of what we do in our spaces, in terms of how we decorate them, in terms of the deliberate things we do to our spaces, at least, how we decorate them, are really in the service of trying to get other people to see us as we see ourselves. And we know that when they do that, people tend to be happier, healthier, more productive when there is a fit between how they are seen and how they see themselves. So I think you know, it's so tempting to think, okay, you know, because our research has shown, you know, there's a lot of things that people do deliberately to their spaces. They put up certain posters. They, you know, they arrange the furniture. They arrange the photos. They do all those sorts of things to think, okay, they're just trying to pull the wool over our eyes. But mainly they're not. But there are other reasons why it's much harder to fake. One reason is that in a physical space, it's very hard to maintain a certain. Impression. So if you were interviewing me and you could say, well, are you organized? I can say, yes, I'm organized. And all it requires is for me to say, yes, I'm organized, right? But to live that life, right, to really be organized in my physical space requires a consistent, persistent behavior. And it's just hard to do that. So, for example, if you look at my CD collection, one day I said, okay, Sam, you're going to get organized. This is what you're going to do. You're going to be an organized person from now. So I went to, you know, IKEA and bought some little CD boxes and labeled them all and, you know, spent hours and hours organizing them. And it was great. It was very, very organized system I had for a day, you know. And then after that day, I don't live that life. I picked it up and then play the CD and then, you know, just put it back somewhere else, or I hadn't left enough space in one of the areas for the, you know, whatever it was, music, so I took it out and put it in. And so it just, if you don't live that life, it's really hard to maintain that. And we certainly saw that in the spaces. We soon learned that there's a difference between somewhere that is a deeply, structurally tidy space and a tidied space, because it's very hard to pull that off. It's hard to pull it off at a deep level. Also, because you just don't see it perceptually. You just don't. If part of personality is associated with how you view the world, right? And so somebody who is high on anxiety really genuinely perceives a world full of threats more than somebody who's low on anxiety. You know, a door slams and somebody who's anxious, like, spins around and says, what was that? Whereas somebody who's not high on it doesn't even notice it. Same thing goes with this this air traffic controller factor, conscientiousness. So one of my colleagues, after going through her space, I said, well, it seems like, you know, you're a very responsible person. You probably show up to your classes on time. She goes, no, you're wrong. Actually, recently, I haven't been showing up to my classes on time. And I thought, oh, that's odd. What's going on? She said, well... I said, what do you mean by that? She goes, well, now I only show up 15 minutes before they start, okay? Which for her, it was this was, you know, all order was breaking down because she now only showed up. Whereas I've, you know, instead of the usual half hour that she used to, be, you know, but whereas I've never shown up 15 minutes before one of my classes start. I would never do that. She was just judging the world by different standards. So it's harder for, so it'd be hard for her to fake. It'd be hard for me to fake. That's why it's hard to fake, because you can't get in the mind of those people, because they just see the world differently.
So what kinds of questions do you ask, or what kinds of things do you look for when you're meeting someone for the first time that will really be able to give you the most revealing glimpse into their into what they're really like?
Yeah. Well, I think that there are a number of ways of thinking about people. So we can talk about a lot of these things we've been talking about so far, which are these traits regularities in behavior. And so you can certainly learn about that. But if you want to go more deeply and learn about somebody. In a more intimate way, you have to go deeper and learn about their attitudes and their values and their goals. And if you want to learn about them even more deeply than that, you need to learn their identity, who they are. And so for their identity, it's really a way of thinking about it is the story they tell about themselves, like who am I? It needn't be accurate. I mean, it can be more or less accurate, but that's not what's crucial, right? Even if we have somebody who somebody may have this story about themselves that they are the hero. You know, they get neglected and, you know, nobody pays any attention to them and everyone is kept, but they come rushing in at the last moment and save the day. You know, so they may have this idea that this is the sort of person they are. Even if that's not true, even if it's not true that that's how they are, to know that person, you have to know that that's how they see themselves. Right, and that doesn't mean it's trivial. It's to really know that person. So there are a number of ways to do that. I think in this case, these photos are really interesting. Photos because of the 10,000 different photos you could choose to display. Why these ones? You know, and they often tell you something. You may not always know what they tell you, and so. So a real important key is looking at placement, because the placement of an item tells you about its psychological function. I was just snooping around some offices last week. I was asked, Newsweek asked me to go around a few of their journalists' offices, and I went around, and what was very interesting was there was one office that was full of so much stuff. It had all kinds of things in there, but what was important to look at was the placement. So and I noticed that all of the there was a whole bunch of old ticket stubs music concerts that the person had been seeing, and they were all here around the desk space. So that told me that this was really important to this person, and versus stuff that was out and that hadn't been attended to. It was really close and close. It was important to how this person saw himself. Now, and I think this gets to another one of the sort of the snooping, tips that I have, and that is people will often say, okay, what can you learn about someone? You know, go into somebody's office, like I was in this at Newsweek. They go into the space and tell us what you think this person's like, this person you've never met. And that is, that's kind of fun to do, but it's not realistic. Right? A far more realistic scenario is that somebody we kind of know, we know them a little bit, and then we go to their space and we want to learn more. And we want to learn stuff that we would find it hard to learn or would take a long time to learn otherwise. And so that's where I think snooping is also very useful, because here I knew, okay, if I want to ask about this office occupant, ask about the tickets. And I later met the guy and he told me why they're important. And I mean, when I first noticed this is when I had just met this friend who at the time I didn't know well, Lisa, and she invited me back to tea at her place, and we went back to tea, and then I excused myself to go to the bathroom. Going through the bathroom, I noticed the bookshelf in the bedroom, and on the top of the bookshelf there was Hemingway's Movable Feast up there, and it was sort of placed on a little platform, and it had been placed for everybody to see, and it was clearly really important. Now, I didn't know what that meant exactly, but I knew it was important to her. So that led me to ask questions that I never would have asked otherwise. I never would have gone to find out those things, but they sort of, by doing that, it directed me to a new source of information.
So how can I check out my boss's desk to gain an insider's understanding into his psyche?
Well, there are a number of things you could do. So a lot of the things that we have talked about. One of the traits that really comes through, as I told you, is this conscientiousness trait and so on. So as you would expect, these people tend to have They have calendars. Now, it's important when you're looking at somebody's desk to look at the difference between how they really are and how they aspire to be. Because many of us, for example, aspire to be organized. I wish I was organized. I'm just not. And so what you'll find in many places, including mine, is you'll find the evidence of people who have aspirations to get it together, right? So you'll find like, you know, a whole you know, unused set of file labels or something like that, you know, and I think I'm going to do it. Or you'll find a calendar, you know, a desk calendar, you know, turned, you know, 20 days, hasn't been turned over for 20 days, or something like that. And so you see these guys, they're aspiring to it, but they just haven't got it together. So that's one thing to look at. There are different types of messes too. So are they messy? Are they very tidy? But if you look at the kind of mess, they've clearly just sort of opened the drawer and just swept everything into it. You know, that's somebody who values tidiness versus somebody who's really tidy to the core. And it's important to mention that some people are messy and wish they weren't, which is somebody like me. And some people are messy and don't care about it. And again, those tell you different things about these people. That would guide your interactions with this person in terms of how you'd act with them. Another thing to look at when you go into somebody's office is the placement of photos, the family photos people have, because those can be very revealing. So if they have photos of themselves, say with their family, or shaking the hands of somebody important, or whatever these are, look at the placement. So if the photos are facing the person who's sitting there, then what they're doing is they are what I would call a social snack. So that is, they are providing the occupant with a emotional snack to sort of see them through the day so they can touch base. So if it's their spouse, it's, oh, I'm away from my spouse, I'm missing my spouse, but I can just look over and see this picture and feel. So it's really telling them that. If it's facing out, right, and many photos, people have their photos facing other people, then it's doing something quite different. It's telling the world, say, hey, look, and my beautiful spouse, look at all my children, and it's really serving a different function. And so I'd pay special attention to that, too. There's all kinds of evidence of, I think in terms of any space, whether it's the office, the living space or you know, the bathroom, whatever, it's very, very useful to try and break it up into different ways we affect the environment. So a lot of the things we do are sort of statements of identity. They're what I call identity claims. That is, we're trying to make a statement to the world. The classic example is having something on your door, whether it's your bedroom door, your postal door, or something like that, because that you don't get to see it if it's on your door. Other people get to see it, but it's really associating certain values and things with yourself. So identity claims you can make to others or to yourself. Then you can also try and affect the space to make you feel a certain way. So you might put up these photos of loved ones, as I said, or a little memento of something. And then the final sort of class of behaviors for telling, where you reveal what you like, not things we do deliberately, but then do things inadvertently. So, for example, I talked about my messy desk, right? My messy desk is not messy because I'm trying to tell people I'm messy. It's not messy because that's my value, to be messy. In fact, it's not. It's messy because I get out a piece of paper and then I kind of get distracted and put down the piece of paper and look, and it's there. And then slowly the sort of sediment builds up. But it's not. I'm not trying to do that. So I think in terms of when you go into your boss's office, go in and try and sort of divide up the clues in terms of these different functions that it's serving, and that will reveal, hopefully, behavioral tendencies and values and goals.
How can I use snooping to help me in a job interview?
Well, job interviews, I mean, you could learn about the person who's interviewing you, if you are in their office. In terms of behaviorally, it's more useful to learn how the behaviors of the person you're interviewing, so an interviewee. So there's all kinds of books on how you should behave in a job interview. You should look relaxed and smile a lot. And indeed, those things do make people like you more. But really, there's the research on job interviewing shows that the one of the main keys to how motivated somebody is how far forward they lean. People who are motivated just want it so bad that they tend to lean further forward. So, but that's something that people miss. So it's one of these things that you wouldn't know, but once you can key into it, it provides some insight into that.
So now that people know this about you and they know what you do, are they more nervous having you around? Do you notice that your friends clean up before you come over? Does it make your dates nervous, that kind of thing?
Yes, but really there's only so much you can do. Again, because for the reasons I said, it's very, very hard to fake it. It's far better just to, I've had to do this myself, is just try and come to terms with who you are. You can do some faking things, but I suppose they are nervous. That is correct.
So, is there some greater good to snooping, or is there is your research going to be used for anything else other than this book?
Well, I think there is some good. To the extent that we can improve how we perceive others, and also improve our understanding of how we are perceived and the sorts of mistakes people are likely to make about us, I think that's very helpful. But I think it's also useful in terms of in other domains too. So Chris Travis is somebody who lives near Austin, where I live, and he runs an architecture firm. And he's really taking this to the next level. I got in touch with him. What he does is I look at how people take a sort of standard space. We all take a standard space, whether it's an office or a living space, and we try to mold it to ourselves a bit. We put up things and we arrange it in a certain way. We try to fit into it. Whereas what Travis does is he starts with the psychology right at the very beginning. So he starts with a very, very in-depth interview about people, about their special objects, about their childhood experiences. It turns out that grandparents' homes tend to be very meaningful to many people. So he gets these in-depth interviews, and then he uses that to, from the very, very beginning, to design the homes. Now, and it might seem more obvious, but that's not obvious, right? Most architects are not about really finding out what people want. A lot of people will pay lip service to it, and those people who do pay attention to what people actually want and what's important to them, right, are often referred to with some sense of derision by architects as builders. Right? They're not really thought of as architects. Architects are the artists, and you shouldn't impose anything on me. Don't try and affect what I'm doing. But he's done some amazing houses. I saw some of his houses, and they really do speak to these core psychological issues of some people. There's one guy there who I met, and he described it, he goes, I'm a view guy. I want views because I like views. And Travis says you often get this with men. And really what this translates to is I want to sort of survey, I want to be able to see all that is mine. Look at my dominion. Look at all I have acquired and known and so on like this. And he says, this stands for a sort of proxy of wanting to be recognized by others who, in a sense, are a proxy for often some father figure they want to impress and so on like that. But people aren't aware of this. They don't experience it. No one comes up and says, I want to be recognized by my father for having accomplished something. They experience this as being a view guy. And there were a few different insights that he got from me. But one of the interesting things about it was that people seem completely unaware, even after they've gone through this process with Travis, they seem completely unaware that the psychology played any role in it. So I spoke to all of these people, and I spoke to five of his clients, and they were all delighted. They say, this house matches us perfectly. And I said, so what role do you think the the psychological interview and so on played in making it the place you like to have. And they, oh, I don't think that was important at all. And they really aren't aware of it. It's really astonishing. And, you know, and it can really affect also. And he uses it in most interesting ways. So, like, when most architects will have a place, they'll label it as kitchen and cooking and bedroom two and something like that. But his plans are labeled by the psychological function they're going to serve. So, one bedroom was labeled as, you know, seclusion, relaxation. Another one was, you know, eroticism. And eroticism and excitement. So they're very he's from the very core starting from that, and he will design it. For example, he can also design it to help couples get along, because he says a lot of the issues in relationships are actually a result of the environment you live in. They're a result of the environment. And so understanding how the problems that people have in communicating and so on, and also what makes a relationship work, he can build that into the house. So there's one couple who are very, very busy, and he said, well, what are these special moments for you? He goes, well, we like to have a cup of coffee together in the morning. So we do that, and this was before, they're both incredibly busy, and so what he did was he designed within their bedroom a coffee bar. There, a little coffee bar within the bedroom, before they had to venture out into the worlds of kids and this and that. And not only that, he has a little porch there which looks out into a nice view. And so not only did that allow them to sort of maintain this sort of ritual for their relationship, but it also informed, because you want the porch so they can look out, the deck so they can look out into their yard, it informed the whole orientation of the house. Because you want to make sure that deck can work. So it goes right back. And I think his stuff is incredibly, it's really taking it to the next level. Where I would like to, if I knew how to do anything like that. Yeah.
Given the political season, mm-hmm. Can snooping predict who somebody will vote for?
Well, it can a bit, right? And we know from research over the past 5 or 10 years, really, is that political orientation is associated with different personalities. I mean, not always, but more or less, that certain people with different orientations tend to value different things. And it turns out that some of these things, some of these behaviors associated with the different orientations are reflected in physical spaces. So what we found, for example, was that people who tend to be high on a conservative political orientation, they tend to be higher on this conscientiousness dimension I mentioned, and also at the same time lower on this Leonardo factor. There tends to be a combination of things, and that's reflected in their space. So the spaces tend to be more organized. They tend to have a narrower variety of books and so on. Whereas people on the liberal side of the spectrum, they tend to have a greater variety of things. They have more things indicating more abstract interests. They have more philosophy, more art supplies. They're doing more things like that. But they also tend to be more messy as well. they're more inviting because they tend to be higher on extroversion too. And so that's one of the clues to extroversion in the space.
You've given a number of talks on this book tour. What are people usually most surprised to find out?
Well, I think that there are a few things. One of them is that these living spaces can be you can learn so much about somebody from these spaces. The other thing is that people really do have this expectation that you can there'll be a tight connection between a certain object and a certain trait. So people often say to me, hey, I have, a stuffed piranha, sitting on my computer. What does that mean? Right? And the answer is, I don't know what it means. But what you have to do is you have to combine the information. So I see experts And expert snooping is far more a matter of building up a case. It's like Hercule Poirot, Agatha Christie's detective, where you're combining information, because often it'll be inconsistent. Often there will be somebody who is high on liberalism, but was a very tidy person. So that is why you have to build the case piece by piece. There's many different reasons why you might have something on your desk. So, for example, for a while I had a religious music CD on my desk, and people came in and thought, "Oh, what does that say about you?" Well, it didn't say anything about me. It said that I was going to teach a class where I was going to play some religious music, you know. So there are many different... The thing is, for any single item in your space, any single item, there are many different paths it could have taken to get there. And so what you do by snooping is by looking at what it is, its state, and its orientation. You try to get the best take on the story to how it got there and what that might tell you about the argument. But you must look for regularities across domains and look for consistencies, and that's what we do there.
We're going to be taking your questions soon, so please start lining up at the mic now if you'd like to ask something. I'm wondering what's next for you. What are your next steps? Where is this research going to take you?
Well, as I said, we've been talking about environments very broadly, including virtual environments. And one of the most interesting spaces right now is Facebook and virtual worlds like that. Because what's staggering about these sorts of places is how much time people spend on them, right? And they spend literally, you know, hours per day. Many people spend hours per day on something like Facebook, and there are millions of people. Like, if MySpace was a country, it'd be like the fourth biggest country in the world or something. It's absolutely staggering. And I think there's so much interesting stuff going on there, and you wouldn't know it. It looks trivial, right? If you look at the conversations people have there, it's like, hey, what's going on? Oh, not much. What's going on with you? Oh, good. You know, how's it going? Good. You know, and if you look at it, you'd think this is just idiotic. It is completely superficial and trivial. But I think it's not. I think some really important psychological needs are being met through what appears to be trivial interactions, and there are many. So really, where I'm taking my research now is looking more at these in terms of what they can tell us about human needs and human interactions.
And what can they tell us?
Well, we can learn. It turns out you can learn quite a lot about someone from their Facebook profile, because we were really interested to say, well, people have these profiles. What is it they're doing? Are they just trying to portray themselves as they'd really like to be, or are they just interacting? I mean, is it more like we did some research before on people's websites, saying where people really project the, you know, where they have the opportunity to project how they want to be. Well, are people with their Facebook profile trying to project an ideal self, or are they just hanging out? Is it more like their telephone, just a medium of communication? And our research suggests very strongly that it's really just another medium of authentic communication, which is why I think, if you're really trying to look good, would you have a conversation like, hey, how's it going? I mean, you wouldn't have these conversations if you were trying to paint yourself in a positive light, you know? Although there is some of that. There's some associating with the right people, you know, making, public association. So there's a lot of different basic psychological processes which are expressed in these contexts. But an interesting thing is that people don't really know. We ask people, how do you think you're viewed on the basis of your Facebook profile? And most people have absolutely no idea. I mean, they think they know, but it doesn't correlate at all with how they are actually seen. So I think they're so rich.
What's been the most fun for you about this whole project?
Well, I guess getting to legitimately go through people's stuff, you know. Say it's my job, you know.
Well, as a reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we're talking with Sam Gosling, the author of Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. I'm Orly Kotel of the Sierra Club. And now we'll take some questions from the audience.
I think based on the way you're describing how you judge people based on their stuff, I would put myself very low on the conscientious scale. I'm very messy. Unintentionally so. Mm-hmm. I aspire to be better. But you also seem to paint a pretty grim picture for my aspirations to be better. And I was wondering if I should just stop fighting it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, there are some things you can do, right? There's a lot of technology and, you know, a lot of advice we can to try and sort of help us as sort of technological crutches to, you know, our deficits. But also it's facing up and to who you are and going with it. I mean, I'm like that too, it's also finding the right niche, right? I mean, it doesn't mean just because you are like that that's, you know, you're doomed, you know? For example, if I was looking for, right, I want my accountants to be really high on this factor, right? I want them to, because they pay attention, they don't miss out, these stuff, you know, everything's in order, they can find everything they want. But I don't want somebody like, you know, somebody who's working like on, say, an advertising campaign for me to do. I want somebody a bit more freewheeling and who isn't so rule-bound and, you know, or something like that. So I think, yes, you should face up and go with who you are, but I don't think it's the end of the road in all domains for you, though. It's all right. There's still hope.
I think with, you know, you touched a little bit on the whole Facebook issue.
Yeah.
With virtual spaces, a lot of people project somewhat of a different personality. You'll have people on Facebook having vampire applications, mm-hmm. or
yeah.
some people may think, you know, completely meaningless things, but they project a certain something about themselves, and then, you know, in contrast to the vampire applications, they'll have like a sweet picture of themselves and their mom in their mm-hmm. bedroom or whatever mm-hmm. it may be. Mm-hmm. So how do you reconcile these kind of differences between what a person projects in their virtual space versus what they do in their physical space?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is one of the reasons why virtual spaces are so interesting. I think somewhere like Facebook, it's a generally pretty good way of learning about people. But I think there are a lot of virtual contexts where it may not be. So, for example, characters in Second Life or playing online video games together where people say, well, what is Facebook for? And I think it's for a whole bunch of different things. I think different people do different things with it. So there may be certain people who want to project, use it more as a device for projection. We've looked at World of Warcraft players, and it turns out that people have very, very different motives for playing World of Warcraft. You know, some people want to use it as just to socialize with others. Some people want to use it to get lost and be immersed in a different world. Some people want to do it to be, they see it as sort of being productive and achieving a lot, which, you know, is a kind of odd way of doing that. But it turns out that the people who have different motivations for these things have different personality profiles in general. But you're right. As a snooper, we are on the lookout for inconsistencies. So, and it may be an inconsistent. So, as an expert snooper, that's exactly what you do. You look at somebody's Facebook profile and say, okay, how does this compare with their other lives? And a great, you know, general rule is you want to say, well, how do places that they have control over and are public compare with places that are private or places they don't have control over? So, if you go into somebody's space and you look at in the public area and you see on the coffee table all the sort of sophisticated, learned books. That's where they have the philosophy and, you know, the literature and the art, right? And then you go through and then you sneak out and look in the bedroom and find all the trashy novels. And you see that, okay, there's a discrepancy. So that would be where you'd be worried that somebody's trying to project something that they may not be. But again, it's this. So I think some people use these spaces to project what they're like, but some people use them to project to try out new things, to try new identities.
Thank you.
Right, there's the finding right in the video games. Right, is that they wanted, like, who is it who, right? Because video game players are overwhelmingly male, so who is it who chooses all the female characters? Right, and a lot of the males choose female characters because they think, if I'm going to spend 7 hours a day in front of this video game, I'd rather be looking at a female character than a male character.
You talked about two different kinds of messy people,
mm-hmm.
the kind of messy people who don't like it and struggle against it and have anxiety around it, and the people who don't care.
Yeah.
I wonder if there are differences between those kinds of people and if you can tell by looking.
Well, can you, by looking at their environments? Yeah. So there, I would look for failed attempts to get their act together, which is good, you know, and that's good. And you know, I have a lot of those myself. And if you looked in my calendar, I would be one of those. You'd see, okay, I've got a desk calendar. I'm going to try and you know, but if and but and it, and superficially, it may look like I'm on the ball. But that's why you have to look carefully. So you look and you say, okay, well, I have my color system. All the birthdays are going to be in blue, and you know, and the doctor's appointments in green, or what you know. But then you'll notice, oh, it kind of breaks down. You know, so it's I think I'll leave it at that. Yeah.
But are there differences between those personalities?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So these are the, I mean, but they're the obvious differences that you would expect is that some people, the people who are messy, they're just sort of laid back, don't care about it. And again, and in interacting with them, it wouldn't, when you're interacting with them, say, hey, you know, it's really important that you get this, you know, report done on time or something like that. And when you're giving them a reason for it, you say, because it would guide the sorts of motivations you might give them. One, you would appeal to order, say, oh, well, we need it because otherwise we won't have all of them and yours will be the one missing, whereas others you might appeal to something else, like we'll fire you if you don't do it or something like that.
Thanks.
Hi. Have you done any research in the disparity between people's spaces, like if they don't match up in the same way that you're getting a reading on someone's room or their office or their car? And sub-question, have you done any research on the spaces that people carry with them personally, like the way that they want to project their image to other people?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Speaking about the first question, we'd love to do that because often people say, hey, I'm really messy at home, but I'm very tidy at work, you know? And I think... And I think that's probably true. And I think it does reflect slightly different personalities in these different places. So that it is really a true reflection. These people are different. They behave differently in these different places. However, I think it is exaggerated. I think people exaggerate because when you're looking at your own behavior, you tend to see these differences that other people wouldn't. So the difference between somebody who sees these between me at home and me at work, although it may seem like a huge difference to me, that difference is actually dwarfed by the difference between me at work and somebody else at work. You know, so I think that they aren't as big as you might see. We didn't have a chance to look at people's difference between people at work and at home, but what we did, the psychology department at University of Texas, where I work, we move buildings. So what we did there was we thought, well, let's see how similar their old and new offices are. So before we moved, I sent my team into people's offices and they filled out personality surveys of what they thought the person was like. And then after we moved to the new building, I sent in a different team and they went and filled out the surveys of what they thought the people were like. And in general, they were very closely correlated. Now, I think they would become even more correlated because I think you'd have exactly this phenomenon of, we all know when you get to a new place, you said, okay, now I'm going to be this sort of person. I'm going to be on the ball. I'm going to be pressed. You know, and I think when you get to a new office, it's a perfect opportunity to try and set yourself up, you know, to be a certain way. But I think if I went back and assessed those offices now, we've been there for 5 or 6 years, the correlation would be even stronger between that because people just give up after a while. I think absolutely in terms of your other question, in terms of appearance, really, I think why I emphasize these three processes that I mentioned earlier about identity claims, people making deliberate statements, self-regulators affecting the environment, how they feel, and behavioral residue, which is these inadvertent consequences of our behavior, things we do which just happen to leave a trace in the environment. Why I emphasize those is because you can apply those principles to all kinds of environments, even environments that we haven't studied. Mm-hmm. But in the case of people's appearance, you can see, well, people clearly have identity statements, what they wear. There's all, you know, a lot of what we is part of an act, a genuine act, though. But also in terms of their appearance as behavioral residue. We have done a little bit of research on that. For example, we have looked at... narcissism and how that's reflected in people's appearance. And it turns out that narcissists, pay more attention to their own appearance. Narcissistic women, for example, tend to show more cleavage than non-narcissistic women. That's one of our findings. They generally wear more makeup. They're more done up and so on like that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. This may surprise you, but we're actually friends on Facebook.
Oh.
So. anyway,
we are there.
But mm-hmm. I only looked at your profile when we were first friends like 6 months ago or something, which leads me to my question. Have you done studies as to how people actually behave with Facebook and their personalities, like other than just like someone's narcissistic if they look at their own profile a whole lot or something?
Mm-hmm. Right. We haven't looked at it very deep. We've done a number of studies and a little bit of research on really the features of their profiles that indicate certain traits. But we thought that the more people had in the about me section, we thought they'd be higher in narcissism. Turns out they're not. But no, we haven't really looked at that very deeply. Nice to see you, friend. Yeah, like that.
What about women and their kitchens?
What's that?
What about women and their kitchens?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Do they consider that their space by and large, or how does
I think
that?
There's a lot of. I haven't done research on kitchens, but you can apply these principles, and there's a lot of different. I think there's a lot of different ways people treat their kitchens. You know, Chris Travis, again, this architect, says that plays in very importantly to how they're designed. He says some places the kitchens are defended, you know, like Fort Knox. He says he builds and that will be built into the design. So he would make sure that there's sort of, you know, areas all around. There's only one entrance point and that there's not, for example, a door to the outside, so you don't have people trekking through it. Other people see it much more as a sort of a means to provide social control over the whole place. Not in a bad way. And others see as a place to commune with others. So there'd be a big preparing area and so on. So I think they serve many different functions to different people, and these would be reflected in the sort of the superficial organization, but in Travis's houses, in terms of actually how they're designed too.
Hi, I'm sort of fascinated by this idea of getting an architect / therapist who's going to build this beautiful house for me that fits my every need. And I've also been known to make like very important professional decisions based on what my cube or office is going to look like.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, does this happen across the board? Because I feel like I've known a lot of people who could live in a cardboard box and they wouldn't really care. And what does it mean if who you are reflects yourself in the surroundings a lot versus not?
Yeah, I think there is quite a lot of variation in how important people's spaces are to them. And you certainly get this when you ask people. Some people say it's not at all important, and that is reflected in the degree to which they personalize them. So it also can reflect people's commitment to a space. So often in people's workspaces, you will see less decoration in places that where people are less committed. It can reflect other things too, which is why you have to take in other things into account. Sometimes people don't want to express themselves, but to people like you, to many people, it's absolutely important. It should be. You spend hours and hours there. You know, and I think there's another application of this research. You know, is it really has shown the importance of giving people the opportunity to express who they are in these spaces, or at least those people who want to.
Hi. You talked about messiness and that sometimes messier people have more of a Da Vinci factor. Did you ever come across hoarding, and what did you learn anything on that topic?
Well, I didn't come across significant hoarding, but you know, I looked into it a little bit as part of the research for this, you know, which is really interesting, because one of the things that was of interest to me is what's the difference between hoarding and collecting, right? Because a lot of people collect and a lot of people, you know. And, you know, and so, you know, clinical psychologists, I'm not a clinical psychologist. Clinical psychologists were very, very helpful here in Philomene. And, you know, one of the big differences is that for most hoarders, and there are a variety of different types of hoarders, it's normally that all the stuff is a source of anxiety and stress for them. Whereas for most, and so the hoarders tend to be higher on neuroticism than non-hoarders, whereas collectors tend to be higher on conscientiousness. They have these items and they like, it's part of how they express their enjoyment for order. But the hoarders are very, yeah, so for example, there's these different varieties of hoarders. There's the, ooh, I might need this one day hoarder, so I've just, who knows? You know, and we all have a little bit of hoarder in us. I mean, and I certainly have hoarding tendencies. You know, I noticed that I was collecting those little bags you get on the plane, which had the toothbrush and the eye patch and all those. I thought, well, I'll keep these. You know, it'll be good in case a guest needs them. You know, and then after you have like 26 of them sitting in the cupboard, all of which are unused, you realize it's time for them to go. But there are other types of hoarders too. Eric Abramson, who has written a book specifically on mess. He talks about narcissistic hoarders, and apparently Andy Warhol was one of these, where you have you're hanging on to your stuff just in case your biographers need it. So it's like, they'll want to know this, you know, they'll want to see this, you know, this napkin that I did a little thing on like this.
We only have a couple more minutes for questions, so we're going to let people go who haven't asked a question yet, if that's okay.
I was just wondering very quickly, you mentioned there was not, in fact, a correlation between Facebook profile length and narcissism. I'm wondering how you measured this what metric you used.
It's a very good question. Because what we did was we had a whole bunch of people who we had assessed very carefully in terms of giving them all kinds of tests and also learning about getting ratings of them from other people and so on. So we had a pretty good, as good a measure as you can get. No measure is perfect, but we had as good a measure as is available for these people. And only subsequently did we realize, we said, oh, let's study Facebook. And so we collected all the Facebook profiles of the people we could and of the people in our study already. And so we could look at their Facebook profiles and just count the number of words.
And did you have, you also actually mentioned cleavage. Did you have any other sort of indicators that were correlating or anti-correlating?
Well, there is apparent attention. Like they tend to be more made up and paying attention to that. Yeah. She can't remember all the findings. Laura probably can, will she? Can you remember all the findings? Designer clothes. Was that? Oh, men, okay, yeah. Narcissistic men, yeah, do not wear eyeglasses. Thank you, Laura.
Have you ever detected psychological disorders from people's space? Have you ever looked at someone's space and said, this person has multiple personality disorder, this person is, you know, completely neurotic and depressed or something like that?
Well, you can pick up certain things. You know, I mean, many disorders are just sort of exaggerated, you know, are the very extremes of ordinary personality traits. So, I mean, you know, obvious ones you can pick up often people with OCD, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, with the, do they have everything in sets of threes and so on like that. There are some obvious things you can do, like look what kind of medication do they have lying around? Is it useful? part of the symptomology of many just symptomology, how do you pronounce that? Whatever it is. Is having disordered lifestyle and disordered spaces. So, you know, you can see that.
And do you disagree with the statement, don't judge a book by its cover?
Yes, I disagree with that statement, yes.
When I was a child, I had a very own point of view on organization. And if you looked at my room, my room was very tidy and polished, but if you opened a closet or a drawer, looked underneath the bed, it was absolute chaos. Mm-hmm. So I wondered, if I look at my life now, I'm kind of like this still and less extreme. But I wonder if you observe people over the course of many years, and I wondered if that changed, or when do these patterns start? At what age, maybe?
Yeah. I think that's absolutely fascinating. I have not specifically done research on that, but I think looking at the developmental antecedents of a lot of these traits is really important. Earlier I mentioned this thing of how our experiences as a kid, often at a grandparent's home or something like that, can be not just a grandparent's, but so it's childhood experiences. I do think affect our general outlook on the world and our general behavior and how we do this. Having spoken to Chris Travis, I remember driving home from and looking at all of his clients and thinking, oh, isn't it quaint how those people are affected by their grandparents' homes? How interesting of them to behave, be so susceptible to it. And then I went home and I opened my refrigerator and I had this epiphany that this is my grandmother. So and because if you look at my refrigerator, it has rows of tonic water going all the way to the back, and soda water's next to it, and the tabs are next to that, and the pineapple, and there's just it's OCD. And I'm not OCD in other domains, but I have this OCD refrigerator, and all the beers and all the, I mean, and right next to the refrigerator is a cupboard. So as soon as one tonic's used, I can put another one there, and it's and I thought, what? Even having done this research, I thought, what on earth is going on here? And then I realized I had this flashbacks to when I was a kid, and we'd go visit my grandmother's. And Travis says grandparents' homes are often good because it was a time when we were happy and free from the stress, and you'd often go to escape, and you could get away. And so I remember where we'd go and play. My brother and I would go and play in the garden. And we were allowed, whenever you got thirsty, she'd say, just go into the drinks cabinet and help yourself to tonic water or bitter lemons, And so it just seemed like, the height of a luxury with the endless tonic water. I mean, it just, we couldn't imagine anything, more opulent than just, tonic water after tonic water, we don't have to count. And so I realized later that I was trying to recreate this feeling of abundance, So I think there's something to that.
Well, let's give a big hand to Sam Gosling for sharing his thoughts and experiences with us tonight. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.